is the flies, he wrote her. No mosquitoes, but flies by day and flies by night, flies in the water, flies in the food. Toward the end of July, the divisions crossed to Lemnos to stage for the reinforcing invasion. That was to divide the peninsula, gain the heights, and outflank the Turkish lines toward Hellas. Hamilton secreted 20,000 men by the dark of the moon into the crowded trenches at a beach called Anzac, halfway up the peninsula, and the Turks were none the wiser. The remainder, some 17,000 new army men, came ashore on the night of August 6, 1915, at Sulva Bay, north of Anzac, to very little opposition. When the Turks learned of the invasion, they moved new divisions down the peninsula by forced march. The objective of the 38th Brigade, what was left of it toward the end, after days and nights of continuous marching and fighting, was an 850-foot hill, Chanuk Bayır, inland a mile and a half from Anzac. To the west of Chanuk Bayır and lower down was another hill with a patch of cultivated ground, the farm. Mosley's column, commanded by Brigadier A.H. Baldwin, struggling up an imprisoning defile a yard wide and 600 feet deep, found its way blocked by a descending train of mules loaded with ammunition. That was Scabby Passage, and the brigadier, in a fury of frustration, led off north toward the farm, over ghastly country in the pitch dark, says the brigade machine gunner, the men falling headlong down holes and climbing up steep and slippery inclines. But they reached the farm. Baldwin's force then held the far left flank of the line of 5,000 British, Australians, and New Zealanders precariously dug into the slopes below the heights of Chanuk Bayır, which the Turks still commanded from trenches. The Turkish reinforcements arrived at night and crowded into the Chanuk trenches, 30,000 strong. They launched their assault at dawn on August 10th, with the sun breaking blindingly at their backs. John Masterfield, the British poet, was there and lived to report. They came on in a monstrous mass, packed shoulder to shoulder, in some places 8 deep, in others 3 or 4 deep. On the left flank, the Turks got fairly in among our men, with a weight which bore all before it, and what followed was a long succession of British rallies to a tussle body to body, with knives and stones and teeth, a fight of wild beasts in the ruined cornfields of the farm. Harry Mosley, in the front line, lost that fight. When he heard of Mosley's death, the American physicist Robert A. Millikan wrote in public eulogy that his loss alone made the war one of the most hideous and most irreparable crimes in history. 6 miles below Dover, down the chalk southeastern coast of England, the old resort and harbor town of Folkestone fills a small valley which opens steeply to the strait. Hills shelter the town to the north. The chalk cliff west sustains a broad municipal promenade of lawns and flower beds. The harbor, where Allied soldiers embarked in great numbers for France, offers the refuge of a deep water pier a third of a mile long, with berths for 8 steamers. The town remembers William Harvey, the 17th century physician who discovered the circulation of the blood as its most distinguished native son. At Folkestone on a sunny, warm Friday afternoon, May 25, 1917, housewives came out in crowds to shop for the Whitsun weekend. A few miles away, at Shorncliffe Camp, Canadian troops mustered on the parade ground. There was bustle and enthusiasm in town and camp alike. It was payday. Without warning, the shops and streets exploded. A line of waiting housewives crumpled outside a greengrocer's. A wine merchant returned to the front of his shop to find his only customer decapitated. Blast felled passers-by in a narrow passage between 2 old buildings. Horses slumped dead between the shafts of carriages. Finely shattered glass suddenly iced a section of street. A conservatory shed its windows. A crater obliterated a tennis court. Fires bloomed from damaged stores. Only after the first explosions did the people of Folkestone notice the sound of engines beating the air. They hardly understood what they heard. They screamed, "Zeps! Zeps!" For until then, Zeppelin dirigibles had been the only mechanism of air attack they knew. "I saw two aeroplanes," a clergyman remembered, who ran outside amid the clamor. "Not Zeppelins, emerging from the disk of the sun almost overhead. Then four more, or five, in a line, and others, all light, bright, silver insects hovering against the blue of the sky. There was about a score in all, and we were charmed with the beauty of the sight." Charmed because aircraft of any kind were new to the British sky, and these were white and large. The results were less charming. 95 killed, 195 injured. The parade ground at Shorncliffe Camp was damaged, but no one was hurt. Folkestone was the little Guernica of the Great War. German Gotha bombers, oversized biplanes, had attacked England for the first time, bringing with them the burgeoning concept of strategic bombing. The England squadron had been headed for London, but had met a solid wall of clouds inland from Gravesend. 21 aircraft turned south then and searched for alternative targets. Folkestone and its nearby army camp answered the need. A Zeppelin bombed Antwerp early in the war as the Germans pushed through Belgium. Churchill sent Navy fighters to bomb Zeppelin hangars at Dusseldorf. Gotas bombed Salonika, and a British squadron bombed the fortress town of Maidos in the Dardanelles during the campaign for Gallipoli. But the Gothas that attacked Folkestone in 1917 began the first effective and sustained campaign of strategic civilian bombardment. It fitted Prussian military strategist Karl von Clausewitz's doctrine of total war in much the same way that submarine attack did, carrying fear and horror directly to the enemy to weaken his will to resist. "You must not suppose that we set out to kill women and children," a captured Zeppelin commander told the British authorities, another rationalization that would echo. "We have higher military aims. You would not find one officer in the German army or navy who would go to war to kill women and children. Such things happen accidentally in war." At first, the Kaiser, thinking of royal relatives and historic buildings, kept London off the bombing list. His naval staff pressed him to relent, which he did by stages, first allowing the docks to be bombed from naval airships, then reluctantly enlarging permission westward across the city. But the hydrogen-filled airships of Count Ferdinand von Zeppelin were vulnerable to incendiary bullets. When British pilots learned to fire them, the stage was set for the bombers. They came on in irregular numbers, dependent in those later years of the war not only on the vagaries of weather, but also on the vagaries, enforced by the British blockade, of substandard engine parts and inferior fuel. A squadron flew against London by daylight on June 13th, 19 days after Folkestone, dropped almost 10,000 pounds of bombs, and caused the most numerous civilian bombing casualties of the war, 432 injured and 162 killed, including 16 horribly mangled children in the basement of a nursery school. London was nearly defenseless, and at first the military saw no reason to change that naked condition. The war minister, the Earl of Derby, told the House of Lords that the bombing was without military significance because not a single soldier had been killed. So the Gothas continued their attacks. They crossed the Channel from bases in Belgium three times in July, twice in August, and averaged two raids a month through the autumn and winter and spring, for a total of 27 in all, first by day and then increasingly, as the British improved their home defenses, by night. They dropped almost 250,000 pounds of bombs, killing 835 people, injuring 1,972 more. Lloyd George, by then Prime Minister, appealed to the brilliant, reliable Smuts to develop an air program, including a system of home defense. Early warning mechanisms were devised, oversized binaural gramophone horns connected by stethoscope to keen, blind listeners, sound-focusing cavities carved into sea cliffs that could pick up the wong-wong of Gotha engines 20 miles out to sea. Barrage balloons raised aprons of steel cable that girdled London's airspace. Enormous white arrows mounted on the ground on pivots guided the radioless defenders in their Sopwith camels and pups toward the invading German bombers. The completed defense system around London was primitive but effective, and it needed only technological improvement to ready it for the next war. At the same time, the Germans explored strategic offense. They extended the range of their Gothas with extra fuel tanks. When daylight bombing became too risky, they learned to fly and bomb at night, navigating by the stars. They produced a behemoth new four-engine bomber, the Giant, a biplane with a wingspan of 138 feet, unmatched until the advent of the American B-29 Superfortress more than two decades later. Its effective range approached 300 miles. A Giant dropped the largest bomb of the war on London on February 16, 1918, a 2,000-pounder that was 13 feet long. It exploded on the grounds of the Royal Hospital in Chelsea. As they came to understand strategic bombing, the Germans turned from high explosives to incendiaries, reasoning presciently that fires might cause more damage by spreading and coalescing than any amount of explosives alone. By 1918, they had developed a 10-pound incendiary bomb of almost pure magnesium, the Electron, that burned at between 2,000 and 3,000 degrees, and that water could not douse. Only hope of a negotiated peace restrained Germany from attempting major incendiary raids on London in the final months of the war. The Germans bombed to establish a basis for peace, by destroying the morale of the English people and paralyzing their will to fight. They succeeded in making the British mad enough to think strategic bombing through. "The day may not be far off," Smuts wrote in his report to Lloyd George, "when aerial operations, with their devastation of enemy lands and destruction of industrial and populous centers on a vast scale, may become the principal operations of the war, to which the older forms of military and naval operations may become secondary and subordinate." The United States Army was slow to respond to gas warfare because it assumed that masks would adequately protect U.S. troops. The civilian Department of the Interior, which had experience dealing with poison gases in mines, therefore took the lead in chemical warfare studies. The Army quickly changed its mind when the Germans introduced mustard gas in July 1917. Research contracts for poison gas development went out to Cornell, Johns Hopkins, Harvard, MIT, Princeton, Yale, and other universities. With what a British observer could now call the great importance attached in America to this branch of warfare, Army Ordnance began construction in November 1917 of a vast war gas arsenal at Edgewood, Maryland, on waste and marshy land. The plant, which cost $35.5 million, a complex of 15 miles of roads, 36 miles of railroad track, waterworks and power plants, and 550 buildings for the manufacture of chlorine, phosgene, chlorpicrin, sulfur chloride, and mustard gas, was completed in less than a year. 10,000 military and civilian workers staffed it. By the end of the war, it was capable of filling 1.1 million 75mm gas shells a month, as well as several million other sizes and types of shells, grenades, mortar bombs, and projector drums. Had the war lasted longer, the British observer notes, there can be no doubt that this center of production would have represented one of the most important contributions by America to the World War. Gas, in any case, was far less efficient at maiming and killing men than were artillery and machine gun fire. Of a total of some 21 million battle casualties, gas caused perhaps 5%, about 1 million. It killed at least 30,000 men, but at least 9 million died overall. Gas may have evoked special horror because it was unfamiliar and chemical rather than familiar and mechanical in its effects. The machine gun forced the opposing armies into trenches. Artillery carried the violence over the parapets once they were there. So the general staffs learned to calculate that they would lose 500,000 men in a 6-month offensive, or 300,000 men in 6 months of ordinary trench warfare. The British alone fired off more than 170 million artillery rounds, more than 5 million tons in the course of the war. The shells, if they were not loaded with shrapnel in the first place, were designed to fragment when they exploded on impact. They produced by far the most horrible mutilations and dismemberings of the war. Faces torn away, genitals torn away, a flying debris of arms and legs and heads, human flesh so pulped into the earth that the filling of sandbags with that earth was a repulsive punishment. Men cried out against the monstrousness on all sides. The machine gun was less mutilating but far more efficient, the basic slaughtering tool of the war. Concentrated essence of infantry, a military theorist daintily labeled it. Against the criminally stubborn conviction of the professional officer corps that courage, elan, and naked steel must carry the day, the machine gun was the ultimate argument. "I go forward," a British soldier writes of his experience in an attacking line of troops. "Up and down, across the ground like a huge ruined honeycomb. And my wave melts away. And the second wave comes up and also melts away. And then the third wave merges into the ruins of the first and second, and after a while the fourth blunders into the remnants of the others." He was describing the Battle of the Somme on July 1, 1916, when at least 21,000 men died in the first hour, possibly in the first few minutes, and 60,000 the first day. Americans invented the machine gun. Hiram Stevens Maxim, a Yankee from Maine. Colonel Isaac Lewis, a West Pointer, director of the U.S. Army Coast Artillery School. William J. Browning, a gunmaker and businessman. And their predecessor, Richard Jordan Gatling, who correctly located the machine gun among automated systems. "It bears the same relation to other firearms," Gatling noted, "that McCormick's Reaper does to the sickle, or the sewing machine to the common needle." The military historian John Keegan writes, "For the most important thing about a machine gun is that it is a machine, and one of quite an advanced type, similar in some respects to a high-precision lathe, in others to an automatic press. Like a lathe, it requires to be set up so that it will operate within desired and predetermined limits. This was done on the Maxim gun by adjusting the angle of the barrel relative to its fixed firing platform and tightening or loosening its traversing screw. Then, like an automatic press, it would, when actuated by a simple trigger, begin and continue to perform its functions with a minimum of human attention, supplying its own power and only requiring a steady supply of raw material and a little routine maintenance to operate efficiently throughout a working shift." The machine gun mechanized war. Artillery and gas mechanized war. They were the hardware of the war, the tools, but they were only proximately the mechanism of the slaughter. The ultimate mechanism was a method of organization. Anachronistically speaking, a software package. The basic lever, the writer Gil Elliott comments, was the conscription law, which made vast numbers of men available for military service. The civil machinery which ensured the carrying out of this law and the military organization which turned numbers of men into battalions and divisions were each founded on a bureaucracy. The production of resources, in particular guns and ammunition, was a matter for civil organization. The movement of men and resources to the front and the trench system of defense were military concerns. Each interlocking system was logical in itself, and each system could be rationalized by those who worked it and moved through it. Thus, Eliot demonstrates, it is reasonable to obey the law. It is good to organize well. It is ingenious to devise guns of high technical capacity. It is sensible to shelter human beings against massive firepower by putting them in protective trenches. What was the purpose of this complex organization? Officially, it was supposed to save civilization, protect the rights of small democracies, demonstrate the superiority of Teutonic culture, beat the dirty Hun, beat the arrogant British, what have you. But the men, caught in the middle, came to glimpse a darker truth. The war had become undisguisedly mechanical and inhuman, Siegfried Sassoon allows a fictional infantry officer to see. What in earlier days had been drafts of volunteers were now droves of victims. Men on every front independently discovered their victimization. Awareness intensified as the war dragged on. In Russia, it exploded in revolution. In Germany, it motivated desertions and surrenders. Among the French, it led to mutinies in the front lines. Among the British, it fostered malingering. Whatever its ostensible purpose, the end result of the complex organization that was the efficient software of the Great War was the manufacture of corpses. This essentially industrial operation was fantasized by the generals as a strategy of attrition. The British tried to kill Germans, the Germans tried to kill British and French, and so on. A strategy so familiar by now that it almost sounds normal. It was not normal in Europe before 1914, and no one in authority expected it to evolve despite the pioneering lessons of the American Civil War. Once the trenches were in place, the long grave already dug, John Masefield's bitterly ironic phrase, then the war stalemated, and death-making overwhelmed any rational response. The war machine, concludes Eliot, rooted in law, organization, production, movement, science, technical ingenuity, with its product of 6,000 deaths a day over a period of 1,500 days, was the permanent and realistic factor, impervious to fantasy, only slightly altered by human variation. No human institution, Eliot stresses, was sufficiently strong to resist the death machine. A new mechanism, the tank, ended the stalemate. An old mechanism, the blockade, choked off the German supply of food and materiel. The increasing rebelliousness of the foot soldiers threatened the security of the bureaucrats. Or the death machine worked too well as against France and began to run out of raw material. The Yanks came over with their sleeves rolled up, an untrenched continent behind them where the trees were not hung with entrails. The war putrefied to a close. But the death machine had only sampled a vast new source of raw material, the civilians behind the lines. It had not yet evolved equipment efficient to process them, only big guns and clumsy biplane bombers. It had not yet evolved the necessary rationale that old people and women and children are combatants equally with armed and uniformed young men. That is why, despite its sickening squalor and brutality, the Great War looks so innocent to modern eyes. 5. Men from Mars. The first subway on the European continent was dug not in Paris or Berlin, but in Budapest. 2 miles long, completed in 1896, it connected the thriving Hungarian capital with its northwestern suburbs. During the same year, the rebuilding of the Grand Palace of Franz Josef I, in one of his dual monarchical manifestations, King of Hungary, enlarged that structure to 860 rooms. Across the wide Danube rose a grandiose parliament, its dimensions measured in acres, 6 stories of Victorian mansard-roofed masonry, bristling with neo-Gothic pinnacles set around an elongated Renaissance dome braced by flying buttresses. The palace, in hilly, quiet Buda, confronted the parliament eastward in flat, bustling Pest. Horse-drawn droshkies, Hungarian physicist Theodor von Karman remembers of that time, carried silk-gowned women and their hussar counts in red uniforms and furred hats through the ancient, war-scarred hills of Buda. But such sights hid deeper social currents, von Karman adds. From the hills of Buda, you could look far beyond Pest onto the great Hungarian plain. The Carpathian Basin enclosed 250 miles to the east by the bow of the Carpathian Mountains that the Magyars had crossed to found Hungary 1,000 years before. Pest expanded within rings of boulevards on the Viennese model, its offices busy with banking, brokering, lucrative trade in grain, fruit, wine, beef, leather, timber, and industrial production only lately established in a country where more than 96% of the population had lived in settlements of fewer than 20,000 persons as recently as 50 years before. Budapest, combining Buda, Obuda, and Pest, had grown faster than any other city on the continent in those 50 years, rising from 17th to 8th in rank, almost 1 million souls. Now coffeehouses, the fountain of illicit trading, adultery, puns, gossip, and poetry, a Hungarian journalist thought, the meeting places for the intellectuals and those opposed to oppression, enlivened the boulevards, parks, and squares, sponsored a cavalry of equestrian bronzes, and peasants visiting for the first time the queen city of the Danube gawked suspiciously at blocks of mansions as fine as any in Europe. Economic takeoff, the late introduction of a nation rich in agricultural resources to the organizing mechanisms of capitalism and industrialization, was responsible for Hungary's boom. The operators of those mechanisms, by virtue of their superior ambition and energy, but also by default, were Jews, who represented about 5% of the Hungarian population in 1910. The stubbornly rural and militaristic Magyar nobility had managed to keep 33% of the Hungarian people illiterate as late as 1918, and wanted nothing of vulgar commerce except its fruits. As a result, by 1904, Jewish families owned 37.5% of Hungary's arable land. By 1910, although Jews comprised only 0.1% of agricultural laborers and 7.3% of industrial workers, they counted 50.6% of Hungary's lawyers, 53% of its commercial businessmen, 59.9% of its doctors, and 80% of its financiers. The only other significant middle class in Hungary was a vast bureaucracy of impoverished Hungarian gentry that came to vie with the Jewish bourgeois for political power. Caught between predominantly Jewish socialists and radicals on one side and the entrenched bureaucracy on the other, both sides hostile, the Jewish commercial elite allied itself for survival with the old nobility and the monarchy. One measure of that conservative alliance was the dramatic increase in the early 20th century of ennobled Jews. George de Hevesy's prosperous maternal grandfather, S.V. Schossberger, became in 1863 the first unconverted Jew ennobled since the Middle Ages, and in 1895 de Hevesy's entire family was ennobled. Max Neumann, the banker father of the brilliant mathematician John von Neumann, was elevated in 1913. Von Karman's father's case was exceptional. Moore Karman, the founder of the celebrated Minta School, was an educator rather than a wealthy businessman. In the last decades of the 19th century, he reorganized the haphazard Hungarian school system along German lines to its great improvement, and not incidentally wrested control of education from the religious institutions that dominated it, and passed that control to the state. That won him a position at court and the duty of planning the education of a young archduke, the emperor's cousin. As a result, writes von Karman, one day in August 1907, Franz Josef called him to the palace and said he wished to reward him for his fine job. He offered to make my father an excellency. My father bowed slightly and said, Imperial Majesty, I'm very flattered, but I would prefer something which I could hand down to my children. The emperor nodded his agreement and ordained that my father be given a place in the hereditary nobility. To receive a predicate of nobility, my father had to be landed. Fortunately, he owned a small vineyard near Budapest, so the emperor bestowed upon him the predicate of von Szolosziszlák, small grape. I have shortened it to von, for even to me, a Hungarian, the full title is almost unpronounceable. Jewish family ennoblements in the 100 years prior to 1900 totaled 126. In the short decade and a half between 1900 and the outbreak of the Great War, the insecure conservative alliance bartered 220 more. Some thousands of men in these 346 families were ultimately involved. They were thus brought into political connection, their power of independent action siphoned away. Out of the prospering but vulnerable Hungarian Jewish middle class came no fewer than 7 of the 20th century's most exceptional scientists. In order of birth, Theodor von Karman, George de Hevesy, Michael Polonyi, Leo Szilard, Eugene Wigner, John von Neumann, and Edward Teller. All 7 left Hungary as young men. All 7 proved unusually versatile as well as talented, and made major contributions to science and technology. 2 among them, de Hevesy and Wigner, eventually won Nobel Prizes. The mystery of such a concentration of ability from so remote and provincial a place has fascinated the community of science. Recalling that galaxy of brilliant Hungarian expatriates, Otto Frisch remembers that his friend, Fritz Houtermans, a theoretical physicist, proposed the popular theory that these people were really visitors from Mars. For them, he said, it was difficult to speak without an accent that would give them away, and therefore they chose to pretend to be Hungarians, whose inability to speak any language without accent is well known, except Hungarian, and these brilliant men all lived elsewhere. That was amusing to colleagues and flattering to the Hungarians, who liked the patina of mystery that romanticized their pasts. The truth is harsher. The Hungarians came to live elsewhere because lack of scientific opportunity and increasing and finally violent anti-Semitism drove them away. They took the lessons they learned in Hungary with them into the world. They all began with talent, variously displayed and remembered. Von Karman at 6 stunned his parents' party guests by quickly multiplying 6-figure numbers in his head. Von Neumann, at 6, joked with his father in classical Greek and had a truly photographic memory. He could recite entire chapters of books he had read. Edward Teller, like Einstein before him, was exceptionally late in learning, or choosing, to talk. His grandfather warned his parents that he might be retarded, but when Teller finally spoke, at 3, he spoke in complete sentences. Von Neumann, too, wondered about the mystery of his and his compatriots' origins. His friend and biographer, the Polish mathematician Stanisław Ulam, remembers their discussions of the primitive rural foothills on both sides of the Carpathians, encompassing parts of Hungary, Czechoslovakia, and Poland, populated thickly with impoverished Orthodox villages. Johnny used to say that all the famous Jewish scientists, artists, and writers who emigrated from Hungary around the time of the First World War came, either directly or indirectly, from those little Carpathian communities, moving up to Budapest as their material conditions improved. Progress to people of such successful transition could be a metaphysical faith. As a boy, writes Teller, I enjoyed science fiction. I read Jules Verne. His words carried me into an exciting world. The possibilities of man's improvement seemed unlimited. The achievements of science were fantastic, and they were good. Leo Szilard, long before he encountered the novels of H.G. Wells, found another visionary student of the human past and future to admire. Szilard thought in maturity that his addiction to the truth and his predilection for saving the world were traceable, first of all, to the stories his mother told him. But apart from those, he said, the most serious influence on my life came from a book which I read when I was 10 years old. It was a Hungarian classic taught in the schools, The Tragedy of Man. A long, dramatic poem in which Adam, Eve, and Lucifer are central characters, The Tragedy of Man was written by an idealistic but disillusioned young Hungarian nobleman named Imre Madach in the years after the failed Hungarian Revolution of 1848. A modern critic calls the work the most dangerously pessimistic poem of the 19th century. It runs Adam through history with Lucifer as his guide, rather as the spirits of Christmas lead Ebenezer Scrooge, enrolling Adam successively as such real historical personages as Pharaoh, Miltiades, the knight Tancred, Kepler. Its pessimism resides in its dramatic strategy. Lucifer demonstrates to Adam the pointlessness of man's faith in progress by staging not imaginary experiences, as in Faust or Peer Gynt, but real historical events. Pharaoh frees his slaves, and they revile him for leaving them without a dominating god. Miltiades returns from Marathon and is attacked by a murderous crowd of citizens his enemies have bribed. Kepler sells horoscopes to bejewel his faithless wife. Adam sensibly concludes that man will never achieve his ultimate ideals, but ought to struggle toward them anyway, a conclusion that Szilard continued to endorse as late as 1945. In Madach's book, he said then, the devil shows Adam the history of mankind, ending with the sun dying down. Only a few Eskimos are left, and they worry chiefly because there are too many Eskimos and too few seals, the last scene before Adam returns to the beginning again. The thought is that there remains a rather narrow margin of hope after you have made your prophecy, and it is pessimistic. Szilard's qualified faith in progress and his liberal political values ultimately set him apart from his Hungarian peers. He believed that group was shaped by the special environment of Budapest at the turn of the century, a society where economic security was taken for granted, as a historian paraphrases him, and a high value was placed on intellectual achievement. The Minta that Szilard and Teller later attended deeply gratified von Karman when he went there in the peaceful 1890s. My father, who founded the school, he writes, was a great believer in teaching everything, Latin, math, and history, by showing its connection with everyday living. To begin Latin, the students wandered the city, copying down inscriptions from statues and museums. To begin mathematics, they looked up figures for Hungary's wheat production and made tables and drew graphs. At no time did we memorize rules from a book. Instead, we sought to develop them ourselves. What better basic training for a scientist? Eugene Wigner, small and trim, whose father managed a tannery and who would become one of the leading theoretical physicists of the 20th century, entered the Lutheran Gymnasium in 1913. John von Neumann followed the next year. We had 2 years of physics courses, the last 2 years, Wigner remembers, and it was very interesting. Our teachers were just enormously good, but the mathematics teacher was fantastic. He gave private classes to Johnny von Neumann. He gave him private classes because he realized that this would be a great mathematician. Von Neumann found a friend in Wigner. They walked and talked mathematics. Wigner's mathematical talent was exceptional, but he felt less than first rate beside the prodigious banker's son. Von Neumann's brilliance impressed colleagues throughout his life. Teller recalls a truncated syllogism someone proposed to the effect that A, Johnny can prove anything, and B, anything Johnny proves is correct. At Princeton, where in 1933 von Neumann at 29 became the youngest member of the newly established Institute for Advanced Study, the saying gained currency that the Hungarian mathematician was indeed a demigod, but that he had made a thorough, detailed study of human beings and could imitate them perfectly. The story hints at a certain manipulative coldness behind the mask of bonhomie von Neumann learned to wear, and even Wigner thought his friendships lacked intimacy. To Wigner, he was nevertheless the only authentic genius of the lot. These earlier memories of the gymnasium days contrast sharply with the turmoil that Teller experienced. Part of the difference was personal. Teller was bored in first-year math at the Minta and quickly managed to insult his mathematics teacher, who was also the principal of the school, by improving on a proof. The principal took the classroom display unkindly.
"So, you are a genius, Teller."
"Well, I don't like geniuses."
But whatever Teller's personal difficulties, he was also confronted directly, as a schoolboy of only 11 years, with revolution and counter-revolution, with riots and violent bloodletting, with personal fear. What had been usually only implicit for the Martians who preceded him was made explicit before his eyes. "I think this was the first time I was deeply impressed by my father," he told his biographers. "He said anti-Semitism was coming. To me, the idea of anti-Semitism was new, and the fact that my father was so serious about it impressed me." Von Karman studied mechanical engineering at the University of Budapest before moving on to Göttingen in 1906. De Hevesy tried Budapest in 1903 before going to the Technische Hochschule in Berlin in 1904 and on to work with Fritz Haber and then with Ernest Rutherford. Szilard had studied at the Technology Institute in Budapest and served in the army before the post-armistice turmoil made him decide to leave. In contrast, Wigner, von Neumann, and particularly Teller experienced the breakdown of Hungarian society as adolescence, Teller at the impressionable beginning of puberty, and at first hand. The revolution arrived as a hurricane, an eyewitness to the Hungarian Revolution of October 1918 recalls. No one prepared it, and no one arranged it. It broke out by its own irresistible momentum. But there were antecedents. A general strike of 500,000 workers in Budapest and other Hungarian industrial centers in January 1918. Another general strike of similar magnitude in June. In the autumn of that year, masses of soldiers, students, and workers gathered in Budapest. This first brief revolution began with anti-military and nationalistic claims. By the time the Hungarian National Council had been formed under Count Mihály Károly, "We can't even manage a revolution without a count," they joked in Budapest in late October, there was expectation of real democratic reform. The council issued a manifesto calling for Hungarian independence, an end to the war, freedom of the press, a secret ballot, and even female suffrage. The Austro-Hungarian dual monarchy collapsed in November. Austrian novelist Robert Musil explained that collapse as well as anybody in a dry epitaph. Es ist passiert. It sort of happened. Hungary won a new government on October 31st, and ecstatic crowds filled the streets of Budapest, waving chrysanthemums, which had become the symbol of the revolution, and cheering the truckloads of soldiers and workers that pushed through. The victory was not easy after all. The revolution hardly extended beyond Budapest. The new government was unable to negotiate anything better than a national dismembering. The founding of the Republic of Hungary, proclaimed on November 16, 1918, was shadowed by another founding on November 20th of the Hungarian Communist Party, by soldiers returning from Russian camps where they had been radicalized as prisoners of war. On March 21, 1919, 4 months after it began, the Republic of Hungary bloodlessly metamorphosed into the Hungarian Soviet Republic. Its head, a former prisoner of war, disciple of Lenin, journalist, Jew born in the Carpathians of Transylvania, Béla Kun. Arthur Koestler, a boy of 14 then in Budapest, heard for the first time the rousing tunes of the Marseillaise and of the Internationale, which, during the 100 days of the Commune, drowned the music-loving town on the Danube in a fiery, melodious flood. It was a little more than 100 days, 133. They were days of confusion, hope, fear, comic ineptitude, and some violence. Toward the end of the war, von Karman had returned to Budapest from aeronautics work with the Austro-Hungarian Air Force, where he had participated in the development of an early prototype of the helicopter. De Hevesy had also returned. Von Karman helped reorganize and modernize the university in the brief days of the Republic, and even served as undersecretary for universities during the Kun regime. He remembered its naivete more than its violence. So far as I can recall, there was no terrorism in Budapest during the 100 days of the Bolsheviks, although I did hear of some sadistic excesses. Lacking a qualified physicist, the university hired De Hevesy as a lecturer on experimental physics during the winter of 1918-1919. Undersecretary von Karman appointed him to a newly established professorship of physical chemistry in March, but De Hevesy found commune working conditions unsatisfactory and went off in May to Denmark to visit Bohr. The two old friends agreed he would join Bohr's new institute in Copenhagen as soon as it was built. Arthur Koestler remembers that food was scarce, especially if you tried to buy it with the regime's ration cards and nearly worthless paper money. But for some reason, the same paper would purchase an abundance of commune-sponsored vanilla ice cream, which his family therefore consumed for breakfast, lunch, and dinner. He mentions this curiosity, he remarks, because it was typical of the happy-go-lucky, dilettantish, and even surrealistic ways in which the commune was run. It was, Koestler thought, all rather endearing, at least when compared to the lunacy and savagery which was to descend upon Europe in years to come. The Hungarian Soviet Republic affected von Neumann and Teller far more severely. They were not admirers like young Koestler, nor yet members of the intellectual elite like De Hevesy and von Karman. They were children of businessmen. Max Teller was a prosperous attorney. Max von Neumann took his family and fled to Vienna. "We left Hungary," his son testified many years later, "very soon after the communists seized power. We left essentially as soon as it was feasible, which was about 30 or 40 days later, and we returned about 2 months after the communists had been put down." In Vienna, the elder von Neumann joined the group of Hungarian financiers working with the conservative nobility to overthrow the commune. Lacking protective wealth, the Tellers stuck it out grimly in Budapest, living with their fears. They made forays into the country to barter with the peasants for food. Teller heard of corpses hung from lampposts, though, as with von Karman's sadistic excesses, he witnessed none himself. Faced with an overcrowded city, the commune had socialized all housing. The day came for the Koestlers, as for the Tellers, when soldiers charged with requisitioning bourgeois excess of floor space and furniture knocked on their doors. The Koestlers, who occupied 2 threadbare rooms in a boarding house, were allowed to keep what they had, Arthur discovering, in the meantime, that working people were interesting and different. The Tellers acquired 2 soldiers who slept on couches in Max Teller's 2 office rooms connected to the Teller apartment. The soldiers were courteous. They sometimes shared their food. They urinated on the rubber plant, but because they searched for hoarded money, which was safely stashed in the cover linings of Max Teller's law books, or simply because the Tellers felt generally insecure, their alien presence terrified. Yet it was not finally Hungarian communism that frightened Edward Teller's parents most. The leaders of the commune, and many among its officials, were Jewish, necessarily since the only intelligentsia Hungary had evolved up to that time was Jewish. Max Teller warned his son that anti-Semitism was coming. Teller's mother expressed her fears more vividly. "I shiver at what my people are doing," she told her son's governess in the heyday of the commune. "When this is over, there will be a terrible revenge." In the summer of 1919, as the commune faltered, 11-year-old Edward and his older sister Emmy were packed off to safety at their maternal grandparents' home in Romania. They returned in the autumn. By then, Admiral Nicholas Horthy had ridden into Budapest on a white horse behind a new national army to install a violent fascist regime, the first in Europe. The Red Terror had come and gone, resulting in some 500 deaths by execution. The White Terror of the Horthy regime was of another order of magnitude, at least 5,000 deaths, and many of those sadistic, secret torture chambers, a selective but unrelenting anti-Semitism that drove tens of thousands of Jews into exile. A contemporary observer, a socialist equally biased against either extreme, wrote that he had no desire whatever to palliate the brutalities and atrocities of the proletarian dictatorship. Its harshness is not to be denied, even if its terrorists operated more with insults and threats than with actual deeds. But the tremendous difference between the red and the white terror is beyond all question. A friend of the new regime, Max von Neumann, brought his family home. In 1920, the Horthy regime introduced a numerus clausus law restricting university admissions, which required that the comparative numbers of the entrants correspond as nearly as possible to the relative population of the various races or nationalities. The law, which would limit Jewish admissions to 5%, a drastic reduction, was deliberately anti-Semitic. Though he was admitted to the University of Budapest and might have stayed, von Neumann chose instead to leave Hungary at 17 in 1921 for Berlin, where he came under the influence of Fritz Haber and studied first for a chemical engineering degree, awarded at the Technical Institute of Zurich in 1925. A year later, he picked up a Ph.D. summa cum laude in mathematics at Budapest. In 1927, he became a Privatdozent at the University of Berlin. In 1929, at 25, he was invited to lecture at Princeton. He was professor of mathematics at Princeton by 1931 and accepted lifetime appointment to the Institute for Advanced Study in 1933. Von Neumann experienced no personal violence in Hungary, only upheaval and whatever anxiety his parents communicated. He nevertheless felt himself scarred. His discussion with Stanislaw Ulam went on more ominously, from identifying Carpathian villages as the ultimate place of origin of Hungary's talented expatriates. "It will be left to historians of science," Ulam writes, "to discover and explain the conditions which catalyzed the emergence of so many brilliant individuals from that area." Johnny used to say that it was a coincidence of some cultural factors which he could not make precise. An external pressure on the whole society of this part of Central Europe, a feeling of extreme insecurity in the individuals, and the necessity to produce the unusual or else face extinction. Teller was too young to leave Hungary during the worst of the Horthy years. This was the adolescent period, as Time magazine paraphrased Teller later, when Max Teller dinned into his son two grim lessons. One, he would have to emigrate to some more favorable country when he grew up, and two, as a member of a disliked minority, he would have to excel the average just to stay even. Teller added a lesson of his own. "I loved science," he told an interviewer once, "but it also offered a possibility for escaping this doomed society." Von Karman embeds in his autobiography a similarly striking statement about the place of science in his emotional life. When the Hungarian Soviet Republic collapsed, he retreated to the home of a wealthy friend, then found his way back to Germany. "I was glad to get out of Hungary," he writes of his state of mind then. "I felt I had had enough of politicians and government upheavals. Suddenly I was enveloped in the feeling that only science is lasting." That science can be a refuge from the world is a conviction common among men and women who turn to it. Abraham Pice remarks that Einstein once commented that he had sold himself body and soul to science, being in flight from the I and the we to the it. But science as a means of escaping from the familiar world of birth and childhood and language, when that world mounts an overwhelming threat, science as a way out, a portable culture, an international fellowship, and the only abiding certitude, must become a more desperate and therefore a more total dependency. Chaim Weizmann gives some measure of that totality in the harsher world of the Russian Pale, when he writes that the acquisition of knowledge was not for us so much a normal process of education as the storing up of weapons in an arsenal by means of which we hoped later to be able to hold our own in a hostile world. He remembers painfully that every division of one's life was a watershed. Teller's experience in Hungary before he left it in 1926 at 17 for the Technical Institute at Karlsruhe was far less rigorous than Weizmann's in the Pale, But external circumstance is no sure measure of internal wounding, and there are not many horrors as efficient for the generation of deep anger and terrible lifelong insecurity as the inability of a father to protect his child. In the last few years, Niels Bohr wrote the German theoretical physicist Arnold Sommerfeld at Munich in April 1922, "I have often felt myself scientifically very lonesome, under the impression that my effort to develop the principles of the quantum theory systematically to the best of my ability has been received with very little understanding." Through the war years, Bohr had struggled to follow, wherever it might lead, the radical change he had introduced into physics. It led to frustration. However stunning Bohr's pre-war results had been, too many older European scientists still thought his inconsistent hypotheses ad hoc and the idea of a quantized atom repugnant. The war itself stalled advance. Yet he persisted, groping his way forward in the darkness. "Only a rare and uncanny intuition," writes the Italian physicist Emilio Segre, "saved Bohr from getting lost in the maze." He guided himself delicately by what he called the correspondence principle. As Robert Oppenheimer once explained it, Bohr remembered that physics was physics, and that Newton described a great part of it and Maxwell a great part of it. So Bohr assumed that his quantum rules must approximate, in situations where the actions involved were large compared to the quantum, to the classical rules of Newton and Maxwell. That correspondence between the reliable old and the unfamiliar new gave him an outer limit, a wall to feel his way along. Bohr built his Institute for Theoretical Physics with support from the University of Copenhagen and from Danish private industry, occupying it on January 18, 1921, after more than a year of delay. He struggled with the architect's plans as painfully as he struggled with his scientific papers. The city of Copenhagen ceded land for the institute on the edge of the Feldepark, broad with soccer fields, where a carnival annually marks the Danish celebration of Constitution Day. The building itself was modest gray stucco with a red tile roof, no larger than many private homes, with four floors inside that looked like only three outside because the lowest floor was built partly below grade, and the top floor, which served the Bohrs at first as an apartment, extended into the space under the peaked roof. Later, as Bohr's family increased to five sons, he built a house next door, and the apartment served as living quarters for visiting students and colleagues. The institute included a lecture hall, a library, laboratories, offices, and a popular ping-pong table where Bohr often played. "His reactions were very fast and accurate," says Otto Frisch, "and he had tremendous willpower and stamina. In a way, those qualities characterized his scientific work as well." In 1922, the year his Nobel Prize made him a Danish national hero, Bohr accomplished a second great theoretical triumph, an explanation of the atomic structure that underlies the regularities of the periodic table of the elements. It linked chemistry irrevocably to physics, and is now standard in every basic chemistry text. Around the nucleus, Bohr proposed, atoms are built up of successive orbital shells of electrons. Imagine a set of nested spheres, each shell capable of accommodating up to a certain number of electrons, and no more. Elements that are similar chemically are similar because they have identical numbers of electrons in their outermost shells, available there for chemical combination. Barium, for example, an alkaline earth, the 56th element in the periodic table, atomic weight 137.34, has electron shells filled successively by 2, 8, 18, 18, 8, and 2 electrons. Radium, another alkaline earth, the 88th element, atomic weight 226, has electron shells filled successively by 2, 8, 18, 32, 18, 8, and 2 electrons. Because the outer shell of each element has two valence electrons, barium and radium are chemically similar, despite their considerable difference in atomic weight and number. that the insecure and contradictory foundation of Bohr's quantum hypotheses, Einstein would say, was sufficient to enable a man of Bohr's unique instinct and perceptiveness to discover the major laws of spectral lines and of the electron shells of the atom, as well as their significance for chemistry, appeared to me like a miracle. This is the highest form of musicality in the sphere of thought. Confirming the miracle, Bohr predicted in the autumn of 1922 that element 72, when discovered, would not be a rare earth, as chemists expected, and as elements 57 through 71 are, but would rather be a valence 4 metal like zirconium. George de Hevesy, now settled in at Bohr's Institute, and a newly arrived young Dutchman, Dirk Coster, went to work using X-ray spectroscopy to look for the element in zircon-bearing minerals. They had not finished their checking when Bohr went off with Margaret in early December to claim his Nobel Prize. They called him in Stockholm the night before his Nobel lecture, only just in time. They had definitely identified element 72. And it was chemically almost identical to zirconium. They named the new element hafnium, after Hafnia, the old Roman name for Copenhagen. Bohr announced its discovery with pride at the conclusion of his lecture the next day. Despite his success with it, quantum theory needed a more solid foundation than Bohr's intuition. Arnold Sommerfeld in Munich was an early contributor to that work. After the war, the brightest young men, searching out the growing point of physics, signed on to help. Bohr remembered the period as a unique cooperation of a whole generation of theoretical physicists from many countries, an unforgettable experience. He was lonesome no more. Sommerfeld brought with him to Göttingen in the early summer of 1922 his most promising student, a 20-year-old Bavarian named Werner Heisenberg, to hear Bohr as visiting lecturer there. "I shall never forget the first lecture," Heisenberg wrote 50 years later, the memory still textured with fine detail. The hall was filled to capacity. The great Danish physicist stood on the platform, his head slightly inclined, and a friendly but somewhat embarrassed smile on his lips. Summer light flooded in through the wide open windows. Bohr spoke fairly softly, with a slight Danish accent. Each one of his carefully formulated sentences revealed a long chain of underlying thoughts, of philosophical reflections, hinted at, but never fully expressed. I found this approach highly exciting. Heisenberg, nevertheless, raised pointed objection to one of Bohr's statements. Bohr had learned to be alert for bright students who were not afraid to argue. At the end of the discussion, he came over to me and asked me to join him that afternoon on a walk over the Hain Mountain, Heisenberg remembers. My real scientific career only began that afternoon. It is the memory of a conversion. Bohr proposed that Heisenberg find his way to Copenhagen eventually so that they could work together. Suddenly, the future looked full of hope. At dinner the next evening, Bohr was startled to be challenged by two young men in the uniforms of the Göttingen police. One of them clapped him on the shoulder. "You are arrested on the charge of kidnapping small children." They were students, genial frauds. The small child they guarded was Heisenberg, boyish with freckles and a stiff brush of red hair. Heisenberg was athletic, vigorous, eager, radiant, a close friend says. He looked even greener in those days than he really was, for being a member of the youth movement, he often wore, even after reaching man's estate, an open shirt and walking